Welcome to Nightfall Narratives with Oxford Public Library. We will be bringing you some of the strange and unusual narratives from the public domain once a week. You can download the audio and listen at your convenience from our website, www.oxfordpl.org, or you can follow us on social media. Now, let's get started. Don't get scared now. By what means the papers out of which I have made a connected story came into my hands is the last point which the reader will learn from these pages, but it is necessary to prefix my extracts from them a statement of the form in which I possess them. They consist, then, partly of a series of collections for a book of travels. They were illustrated with woodcuts or steel plates. They gave details of hotel accommodations and of means of communication, such as we now expect to find in any well-regulated guidebook. In a word, they were chatty. Begun with the idea of furnishing material for such a book, my papers, as they progressed, assumed the character of a record of one single personal experience, and this record was continued up to within a very short time from its termination. The writer was a Mr. Raxall. For my knowledge of him, I have to depend entirely on the evidence his writings afford, and from these I deduce that he was a man past middle age and very much alone in the world. He had, it seems, no settled abode in England, but was a denizen of hotels and boarding houses. As to his character, it is not difficult to form some superficial opinion. He must have been an intelligent and cultivated man. It seems that he was near being a fellow of his college at Oxford. His besetting fault was pretty clearly that of over-inquisitiveness. Possibly a good fault in a traveler, certainly a fault for which our traveler paid dearly enough in the end. On what proved to be his last expedition, he was plotting a book. Scandinavia, a region not widely known to the Englishman 40 years ago, had struck him as an interesting field, and he set out thither in the early summer of 1863. I need only mention that some savant resident there put him on the track of an important collection of family papers belonging to the proprietors of an ancient manor house in Vestergothland, and obtained for him permission to examine them. The manor house in question is one of the best buildings of its kind in all the country. It was built soon after 1600 and is very much like an English house of that period. They received Mr. Raxall with great kindness and courtesy, and pressed him to stay in the house as long as his researches lasted. But preferring to be independent and mistrusting his powers of conversing in Swedish, he settled himself in the village inn, which turned out quite sufficiently comfortable. This arrangement would entail a short walk daily to and from the manor house of something under a mile. The house itself stood in a park and was protected, we should say grown up, with large old timber. Near it you found the walled garden and then entered a close wood fringing one of the small lakes with which the whole country is pitted. Then came the wall of the demon and you climbed a steep knoll, and on top of this stood the church. Fenced in with tall dark trees, it was a curious building. Such sights as these may be seen in many a church in Sweden now, but what distinguished this one was an addition to the original building. At the eastern end of the northern aisle, the builder of the manor house had erected a mausoleum for himself and his family. To this mausoleum there was no access from the church. On the first day of his stay, Mr. Raxall found the church door open into the mausoleum. However, he could not make his way. He could, by looking through the keyhole, just descry that there were fine marble effigies and sarcophagi of copper, and a wealth of armorial ornament, which made him very anxious to spend some time in investigation. The papers he had come to examine at the manor house proved to be of just the kind he wanted for his book. There were family correspondence, journals, and account books of the earliest owners of the estate, very carefully kept and clearly written, full of amusing and picturesque details. The first De La Gardie appeared in them as a strong and capable man. Shortly after the building of the mansion, there had been a period of distress in the district, and the peasants had risen and attacked several chateaux and done some damage. The owner of Roebuck took a leading part in suppressing the trouble, and there was reference to executions of ringleaders and severe punishments inflicted with no sparing hand. The portrait of Magnus De La Gardie was one of the best in the house, and Mr. Raxall studied it with no little interest after his day's work. I gather that the face impressed him rather by its power than its beauty or goodness. In fact, he writes that Count Magnus was an almost phenomenally ugly man. "I must remember," he writes, "to ask the sexton if he can let me into the mausoleum at the church. He evidently has access to it himself, for I saw him tonight standing on the steps, and I thought locking or unlocking the door." His object, he says, was to find out whether any traditions on Count Magnus De La Gardie were favorable or not. He found that the count was decidedly not a favorite. If his tenants came late to their work on the days which they owed to him as lord of the manor, they were set on the wooden horse or flogged and branded in the manor house yard. One or two cases there were of men who had occupied lands which encroached on the lord's domain and whose houses had been mysteriously burnt on a winter's night with the whole family inside. Also, the count had been on a black pilgrimage and had brought something or someone back with him. You would naturally inquire, as Mr. Raxall did, what the black pilgrimage may have been, but your curiosity on the point must remain unsatisfied for the time being, just as his did. The landlord was evidently unwilling to give a full answer. In the afternoon, he had done with these papers, and after returning the boxes in which they were kept to their places on the shelf, he proceeded to take down some of the volumes nearest them. The shelf that he'd hit upon was occupied mostly by a collection of account books in the writing of the first Count Magnus, but one among them was not an account book. It was a book of alchemical other tracts in another 16th century hand. Not being very familiar with alchemical literature, Mr. Raxall spends a good deal of space which he might have spared in setting out the names and beginnings of the various treatises. The Book of Phoenix, Book of 30 Words, Books of Toad, Book of Miriam, Turba Philosophorum, and so forth. And then he announces, with a good deal of circumstance, his delight at finding, on a leaf originally left blank near the middle of the book, some writing of Count Magnus himself. It is true that only a few lines were written, but there was quite enough to show that the landlord had that morning been referring to a belief at least as old as that time of Count Magnus, and probably shared by him. This is the English of what was written. If any man desires to obtain a long life, if he would obtain a faithful messenger and see the blood of his enemies, it is necessary that he should first go into the city of Chorazin and there salute the prince. Here there was an erasure of one word, not very thoroughly done, so that Mr. Raxall felt pretty sure that he was right in reading it as of the air. But there was no more of the text copied, only a line in Latin. It could not be denied that this threw a rather lurid light upon the tastes and beliefs of the Count, but to Mr. Wraxall, separated from him by nearly 3 centuries, the thought that he might have added to his general forcefulness alchemy? And to alchemy something like magic? Only made him a more picturesque figure, and when, after a rather prolonged contemplation of his picture in the hall, Mr. Wraxall set out on his homeward way, his mind was full of the thought of Count Magnus. He had no eyes for his surroundings, no perception of the evening scents of the woods or evening light on the lake. And when all of a sudden he pulled up short, he was astonished to find himself already at the gate of the churchyard, and within a few minutes of his dinner, his eyes fell on the mausoleum. "Ah," he said, "Count Magnus, there you are. I should dearly like to see you." Like many solitary men, he writes, "I have a habit of talking to myself aloud, and unlike some of the Greek and Latin particles, I do not expect an answer." Certainly, and perhaps fortunately in this case, there was neither voice nor any that regarded. Only the women who, I suppose, were cleaning up the church dropped some metallic object on the floor, whose clang startled me. Count Magnus, I think, sleeps sound enough. That same evening, the landlord of the inn, who had heard Mr. Wraxall say that he wished to see the clerk of the parish, introduced him to that official in the inn parlor. A visit to the De La Gardie tomb house was soon arranged for the next day, and a little general conversation ensued. Mr. Wraxall, remembering that one function of Scandinavian deacons is to teach candidates for confirmation, thought he would refresh his own memory on a biblical point. "Can you tell me," he said, "anything about Chorazin?" The deacon seemed startled, but readily reminded him how the village had once been denounced. "To be sure," said Mr. Wraxall, "it is, I suppose, quite a ruin now." "So I suspect," replied the deacon. "I have heard some of our old priests say that Antichrist is to be born there, and there are tales." "Ah, what tales are those?" Mr. Wraxall put in. "Tales, I was going to say, which I have forgotten," said the deacon, and soon after that, he said good night. The next day, Mr. Wraxall records that the deacon called for him soon after his breakfast and took him to the church and mausoleum. He noticed that the key of the latter was hung on a nail just by the pulpit, and it occurred to him that as the church door seemed to be left unlocked as a rule, it would not be difficult for him to pay a second and more private visit to the monuments if there proved to be more of interest among them than could be digested at first. The building, when he entered it, he found not unimposing. The monuments were dignified if luxuriant. The central space of the domed room was occupied by 3 copper sarcophagi. 2 of them had a large metal crucifix on the lid. The third, that of Count Magnus, had instead a full-length effigy engraved upon it, and round the edge were several bands of similar ornament, representing various scenes. One was a battle with a cannon belching out smoke, and walled towns and troops of pikemen. Another showed an execution. In a third, among trees, was a man running at full speed with flying hair and outstretched hands. After him followed a strange form. The figure was unduly short and was, for the most part, muffled in a hooded garment which swept the ground. This, then, which is eventually an allegorical representation of some kind of fiend pursuing a hunted soul. Mr. Wraxall noted the finely worked and massive steel padlocks, 3 in number, which secured the sarcophagus. One of them, he saw, was detached and lay on the pavement, and then, unwilling to delay the deacon longer or waste his own working time, he made his way onward to the manor house. "It is curious," he notes, "how on retracting a familiar path one's thoughts engross one to the absolute exclusion of surrounding objects. Tonight, for the second time, one had entirely failed to notice where I was going. I had planned a private visit to the tomb house to copy epitaphs, when I suddenly, as it were, awoke to consciousness and found myself, as before, turning in at the churchyard gate and, I believe, singing or chanting some such words as, "Are you awake, Count Magnus? Are you asleep, Count Magnus?" And then something more, which I have failed to recollect. It seemed to me that I must have been behaving in this nonsensical way for some time. He found the key to the manor house where he had expected to find it, and copied the greater part of what he wanted. In fact, he stayed until the light began to fail him. "I must have been wrong," he writes, "in saying that one of the padlocks of my count's sarcophagus was unfastened. I see tonight that two are loose. I picked both up and laid them carefully in the window ledge, after trying unsuccessfully to close them. The remaining one is still firm, and though I take it to be a spring lock, I cannot guess how it is opened. Had I succeeded in undoing it, I am almost afraid I should have taken the liberty of opening the sarcophagus. It is strange, the interest I feel in this personality of this, I fear, somewhat ferocious and grim old noble." The day following was, as it turned out, the last of Mr. Raxall's stay at Roebuck. It was verging on 6:30 before he was outside the iron gates of Roebuck. He dwelt on every step of his walk by the lake, determined to saturate himself. Now that he trod it for the last time, in the sentiment of the place and hour. And when he reached the summit of the churchyard knoll, he lingered for many minutes, gazing at the limitless prospect of woods near and distant. When at last he turned to go, the thought struck him that surely he must bid farewell to Count Magnus. The church was but 20 yards away, and he knew where the key to the mausoleum hung. It was not long before he was standing over the great copper coffin, and, as usual, talking to himself aloud. "You may have been a bit of a rascal in your time, Magnus," he was saying, "but for all that I should like to see you, or rather, just at that instant," he says, "I felt a blow on my foot. Hastily enough, I drew back, and something fell on the pavement with a clash. It was the third, the last of the three padlocks which had fastened the sarcophagus. I stooped to pick it up, and before I had raised myself, there was a sound of metal hinges creaking, and I distinctly saw the lid shifting upwards. I may have behaved like a coward, but I could not for my life stay one moment. I was outside that dreadful building in less time than I can write the words, and what frightens me more, I could not turn the key in the lock. As I sit here in my room, noting these facts, I ask myself whether that noise of creaking metal continued, and I cannot tell whether it did or not. I only know that there was something more than I have written that alarmed me, but whether it was sound or sight, I am not able to remember. What is this that I have done?" Poor Mr. Raxall. He set out on his journey to England on the next day, as he had planned, and he reached England in safety. And yet, as I gather from his changed hand and inconsequent jottings, a broken man. One of several small notebooks that have come to me with his papers gives not a key to, but kind of an inkling of his experiences. Much of his journey was made by canal boat, and I find not less than 6 painful attempts to enumerate and describe his fellow passengers. The entries are of this kind. 24. Pastor of village. Usual black coat and soft black hat. 25. Commercial traveler from Stockholm going to Trollhättan. Black coat, brown hat. 26. Man in long black cloak, broad leafed hat, very old-fashioned. This entry is lined out. A note added. Perhaps identical with number 13. Have not seen his face. On referring to number 13, I find that he is a Roman priest in a cassock. The net result of the reckoning is always the same. 28 people appear in the enumeration, one being always the man in a long black cloak and broad hat, and the other a short figure in a dark cloak and hood. On the other hand, it is always noted that only 26 passengers appear at meals, and that the man in the cloak is perhaps absent, and the short figure is certainly absent. On reaching England, it appears that Mr. Wraxall landed at Harwich, and that he resolved at once to put himself out of the reach of some person or persons whom he never specifies, but whom he had evidently come to regard as his pursuers. Accordingly, he took a vehicle. It was about 9 o'clock on a moonlit August night when he neared the place. He was sitting forward and looking out of the window at the fields and thickets racing past him. Suddenly he came to a crossroads. At the corner, two figures were standing motionless. Both were in dark cloaks. The taller one wore a hat, the shorter a hood. He had no time to see their faces, nor did they make any motion that he could discern, yet the horses shied violently and broke into a gallop, and Mr. Wraxall sank back into his seat in something like desperation. He had seen them before. At Belchamp, St. Paul, he was fortunate enough to find a decent lodging. His last notes were written on this day. He is expecting a visit from his pursuers. How or when, he knows not. And his constant cry is, what has he done? And is there no hope? Doctors, he knows, would call him mad, and policemen would laugh at him. The parsons is away. What can he do but lock the door and cry to God? People still remembered how a strange gentleman came, and how the next morning he was found dead, and the jury that viewed the body fainted. And none of them wouldn't even speak to what they see. And the verdict was visitation of God. It so happened that last year the little house came into my hands as part of a legacy. It had stood empty since 1863, and there seemed no prospect of letting it. So I had it pulled down. And the papers of which I had given you an abstract were found in a forgotten cupboard under the window in the bedroom. This has been Nightfall Narratives with Oxford Public Library. We hope you enjoyed these strange and unusual stories. We will see you again soon. Goodbye for now.